You are listening to the Poetry Saloncast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. The Poetry Salon is on a mission to make inspiration, education, and an inspiring community affordable and available to poets and writers around the world. To find out more about our workshops, classes, editing services, and events, visit www.thepoetrysalon.com. Now, please enjoy our interview with this week's guest poet. Now, please enjoy our interview with this month's guest poet.
Lviv, Ukraine. Long before Reuters and BBC reporters signed off from it, Lviv, Ukraine, was my hometown. I knew it by another name, Lvov, Ukrainian Republic, USSR. Is like anyone's childhood, I suppose, a dot on the map of time that no longer exists. None of us can ever go back to our soul's point of entry into this world. Lviv was Ukrainian, Soviet, Russian, Polish, Slavic, Austro-Hungarian territory, and all of them hated the Jews more or less equally. You see how tugging one tongue can unspool the entire tapestry? Lvov is the name of my birth city in Russian, which is my mother tongue. My father's first language was Yiddish, but that is also not the whole story, simply another forbidden melody, a compromise of German and Hebrew, of heart and geography. A plundered treasure reaching its golden roots all the way to Aramaic grains of sands. Ancient alphabets, some mystics believe, house the true name of God. Once known, a word to unlock understanding. If only we could speak it, placing the right accent on the right syllable. Naming God is an ambition I do not share. I'm only trying to unpack one girlhood's worth of beginning, each language a nesting doll, carrying inside itself all the recipes and ingredients of a people, their poetry and their death certificates, their libraries, songs, and kill orders, health records, love letters, addresses we can't return to, and none of it is enough. I'm still looking to find that word for where I come from. Even though the news reports mention it hourly, Lviv, Ukraine, war, refugee, near constant bombardment, bravery, devastation, one thing always means so many other things. And nothing has just one name to answer to. Just one life to answer for. All the bad girls wear Russian accents. In the movies, villains have accents, sometimes German, but mostly Russian. Hard-edged lyrics of something forbidden, severe haircuts, steel blue eyes, and an appreciation for Tchaikovsky, for a black swan kind of life, for fairy tales built from curses. Say something in Russian, the boys beg me in school, hoping for death threats, nuclear arms codes, or at least a good cuss word or two. I answer, Krasavitsa, a bullet through every consonant, bare my teeth on the V, exhale over that last ah, imply red lipstick. What does it mean? I don't tell them, only smile as they try to shape the unfamiliar with their mouths, repeating my mangled conviction over and over, laughing. They will shout it after me, I know from experience. Throw it out with pride for remembering the next time they see me, maybe even use it as a perpetual greeting for the only Russian speaker they know, which is why I don't teach them anything ugly. It will only be poured back over me later, a feedback loop quicker than some. Krasavitsa in Russian means gorgeous woman, which in the movies, all the best villains are.
You have been listening to Jane Mushinets, our guest today on the Poetry Salon cast. Jane, that was lovely. And I just want to say, I'm so glad you read both of those poems. The last one, especially the title of your poetry collection. Before we get into that, though, let me read your biography. Jane is Ukrainian-born, Russian-speaking Jew. Jane Yevgenia Mushinets was granted asylum in the U.S. as a refugee from the USSR at 10 years old. Today, she's a full-grown MIT nerd, emerging writer, and mom to two very American kids. In 2022, Jane won the Good Life Review Poetry Prize and was shortlisted for the Jakar Press Chapbook Prize. Her first poetry chapbook, All the Bad Girls Wear Russian Accents, was published by Kelsey Books in 2023. Jane, welcome to the podcast. Tell me just one more time, how do I pronounce both your Russian first name and your last name?
It's a common question. Thank you. First of all, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here. And my name is Jane Yevgenia Mushinets.
And what does her family call you?
Zhenya.
Okay.
Which is the short version of Yevgenia.
Yeah, I always wonder about that because I've worked with a lot of people from different countries and sometimes they have an Americanized name and I want to be respectful and I can learn new names and everything. And so I'm game for that. I'm game for learning somebody's preferred name, but I know a lot of...
You did a great job pronouncing my name, so you should feel very proud.
I appreciate that. I try the phonetics and everything. But very happy to have you here. And I'm really glad that you were reading the titular poem, the title poem from your collection, because I have some specific questions about that. But we'll get into that in a little bit. Before we do, I want to also say how I know you personally. I read your bio, but I know you because we both were published in Sheila Nagig, wonderful
That's
journal.
Right.
Definitely want to recommend people. I want to recommend people read it. I want to recommend people submit to it. If you're one of our listeners who's also a poet and submits writing. And I was just really taken with your writing. It's modern. It's fun. You're talking about some very serious subject matter, but you've got a lot of playfulness to it, a lot of playfulness with the stereotypes. And I thought that was really intriguing, especially at a time right now where, you know, Russia and Ukraine are so much in everyone's consciousness. And you have an ability to talk about it on a much more personal level. So I thought this would be a really good opportunity to, find out more about you and your poetry and your experience and how what's going on a global level is relating to you personally and artistically. So again,
yes.
Thanks for being here. Some light topics to cover.
Yeah, nothing major. War. There's serious things going on in the world. And first, Sheila Nagig, I have to say, is fantastic. Haley Hagen is also going to be publishing my next chapbook, which is coming out next year. So thank you to Sheila Nagig for not only introducing us, but also to supporting emerging writers and poets. It's a very wonderful publication. And this idea of being playful and still having a sense of humor in the midst of hard things is very much prevalent throughout my collection. And that was one of the things I really wanted to bring out, that we can talk about difficult issues without having to despair of our own lives. We have to find a way towards hope. And often poetry maybe gets a bit of a rep for embracing the darkness within and without to the all exclusion of joy.
Yes.
And if it does embrace joy, then it's somehow trite or maybe not, you know, not vital. And I really wanted to put forth both of those things because, you know, everything has so many different sides.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. And I have absolutely heard that, felt that before. I feel like in my poetry, I tend to always gravitate towards something darker. Like even if I'm having a great day, if I sit down to write a poetry yeah. prompt, I'll immediately think of the worst thing that's happened this week. And that's what I want to write about. But yeah, you absolutely can make it a vehicle for exploring all the different facets of our personality. And joy is one of them. And humor is a big part of how I think we all get through the day. And so bravo to that. I want to ask a little bit about the book in general before we get into specific poems. So can you tell me a little bit about how you knew you had not just individual poems, but a full collection, and what bringing this chapbook out was like? How was that birthing process for you?
Sure. So I am very honored to be here on the podcast, which has had so many established and wonderful authors and poets who I admire, especially because I'm so early in my poetic career. So for me, this whole process was really a discovery process of what publication and poetry is in general today. And I had always felt that I was a poet in my heart, but it took the pandemic for me to really come back to it. And I had only begun publishing poetry in the fall of 2020. So that was my first poem. And it was my first poem I ever wrote, but it was the first one that I sent out and got accepted. And it really encouraged me. And I started like learning what was possible. And I had learned, that was when I understood that there were such things as chapbooks, which is a short collection. I had always been intimidated by writing a long book. And that's why I think poetry was a friendly thing to start with, because it's short and you can put it together. For me, it came more easily than other kind of writing. And so as I started getting more poems published, I thought, okay, well, maybe I can put them together somehow, because now I have an 30 or 40 that I could potentially fit. And it started at first as a collection, and I titled it Poems Found Around the House, because that's what I had been doing. I had been sort of around the house and putting things in. Most of those poems made it into this book. Then as the political climate changed in our country and my poems started to reflect my, you know, concepts of having to flee as a refugee and what that meant to be here and my political identity, my American identity. And then the war came. So the collection changed. I understood it to be much more about where I come from. And then I retitled it Mother Tongue. And I sent it out. And I got some encouraging feedback, but no one accepted it. But that was more, I got more encouraging feedback from that. And then there were two poems. So the title poem of this collection, All the Bad Girls Wear Russian Accents, was one of the last poems that I wrote. And once I wrote that, the whole collection changed, because I knew that was the title, and I then rearranged everything together to fit that theme. And in that moment, I understood that a collection of poems wasn't just that they had a common theme. Like the first two versions of it, they had common themes. They were all, you know, about domestic issues, or all about, you know, where you come from. But in this case, having this title and as I started to play with the order, they all said something bigger together. It wasn't just that they shared a theme and they made sense as a packet. It was that as I began to place them, I began to build a journey for the reader, each new poem, so that each of these poems said some things by themselves, and they said something new because they were indexed in between two other poems. And then when you got to the end as a whole, they said something together.
Yeah.
And that was really fantastic.
So you've only had your first poem published 3 years ago. So it's 3 years from first publication to a full chapbook. That's pretty remarkable.
It was. It did not feel fast, but when I had, it takes a year to bring a book out, and this one came out in February of this year. So about a year and a half from my first publication, I had my manuscript accepted by Kelsey Books, who is amazing and wonderful. So yes, when you say it like that, it feels very fast. But to me, who has felt like she was a poet since she was 4 years old, but now I'm 45, it felt like, oh, this was a long time coming.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. And I, of course, I think, you know, looking at my own impatience, of course, if someone told me, oh, it's only 3 years between starting and having a book, that feels like an eternity. But now, knowing how long it can take for a book to come out, I feel like 3 years is really fast comparatively.
It's really fast.
So tell me a little bit more about that. Can you tell me a little bit about what made you start wanting to get your work and put it out there?
I think when I was in high school, I kind of sent it off. But that was a very different proposition than it is now, because nothing was online. It was you had to do a hard copy mailing of things, and then it wasn't successful. Oh. And I thought, well, I don't know that I could make this a career. And I had felt, since we immigrated here as refugees, my parents were the immigrant parents. You got to stand on your own 2 feet. You got to pay the bill. We didn't, you know, take you out of there so you could be kind of rootless and a poet.
Yeah.
Or like, be a poet, but that's not a career. That's a hobby.
Yeah.
And so I stepped away from my love of poetry, and I didn't understand that I was internalizing this message that poetry wasn't important.
Mm.
You think you'll always have time for something, but then life happens. You start pursuing your career, you start a family, you do other things. And then I realized during the pandemic, I think all of us had a bit of a reckoning in terms of how do we survive this terrible time? And who am I when I'm not all these other things, when we're no longer going to work or we're no longer having the regular schedule? It occurred to me that it had been years since I had written, and I used to write all the time. And it made me absolutely devastated to have that realization.
Mm.
At the same time, I thought, well, if I died tomorrow, what would be my regrets? And not having tried to write, now that I was a grown up and I had better skills than a 16-year-old version of me to try to make a go of something, that would have been a real shame. So I said, you know what, I'm going to try this thing. And my background is in business. So I had built up really strong skills in trying to, you know, manage a project to its success. So I used my business skills to kind of approach this. And I said, okay, I'm going to give it a year or 100 rejections. Let's go. Let's do it. I totally got to the 100 rejections, by the way.
I gave it a lot longer than a year. I think I had been writing for 3 years, and I probably didn't get to 100 rejections, but it was 3 years of writing solidly, editing solidly, and sending some work out on a semi-regular basis before I had my first acceptance. And I certainly would hope that even if you hadn't gotten something accepted in a year, you would have kept going. What do you think?
I think I would have. I think, yeah. I needed to kind of frame it in a way that it wasn't so big and scary, and all my insecurities and what ifs and whatnot didn't derail me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the other piece, is I really took things apart in terms of what success looked like. So success could not look like getting your poem published. Success had to look like writing the poem, being happy with it. And success had to look like, oh, finding a place. I had to really separate those little steps. I spent time and I found a journal that I think I want to submit to. That is a success. Oh, I submitted that's the success. So these were things that were in my control. It was not in my control whether that journal was going to accept it, right?
Yes.
So by putting things that I celebrated and rewarded into something that was very practical and tangible, totally doable, it helped me celebrate those little steps and those little successes, which were huge and big for me, because I had been too scared and somehow unable to do it otherwise.
Yeah, this could be a course in task management, you know, how to stay motivated. And absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, my background is in the psychology of creativity, and I've worked with kids a lot, and even just working with myself, I know that trying to manage a big project, a novel, a book of poems, you have to break it down into little projects and give yourself a win. Absolutely. Even if the world isn't giving you a win, you've got to give yourself that little pat on the back.
And being a mom also helped, because you would never tell your three-year-old when she was doodling something that, okay, well, it's not as good as the other three-year-olds. So maybe, maybe drawing's not your thing. You know,
Some parents.
You would never do that. And so you kind of have to recognize where you're at in your writing journey.
Yes.
And yeah, maybe you've been journaling and maybe you've been secretly writing your whole life, that's fine. But how long have you actually tried to get things published legitimately? So you're basically, you know, a 6-month-old or a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old in this process.
Yeah. That's wonderful. That seems to be something that we are still learning as a species and as a culture, that is important.
I heard someone speak about it, and it was on one of those psychology, you know, how do we live a better life podcasts. And they were saying, like, no one's going to tell, you know, if someone isn't walking by the time they're one, no one's going to be like, oh, well, John's not a walker. You know? If the child needs assistance, they will give them the assistance. And if they just need more time, they'll give them more time. You know, so I kind of laughed at that. I'm like, yeah, that's so true.
Yes. Well, that's a good segue for me to ask now about your writing process. So when you got back into it as an adult, what did you do in order to teach yourself or reteach yourself or re-inspire yourself to write?
So I have a high inner self-critic, I had to really watch out for her. And I really looked at the fact that when I tried to do kind of like big things, they were difficult to do. Mm-hmm. So what worked for me was I would have these ideas that would come to me, and they were not complete poems. Or sometimes I would sit down and I would write, but only a little bit would come out. So I promised myself that if I got a little spark of an idea, I would just write it down, because it would happen to me throughout my day, but I would just say, oh, okay. And then I wouldn't pay attention to it, and I wouldn't give it any kind of notice. I would continue to do the laundry or to do the, because I was so busy in my life, and I'm so busy, too busy to write.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, keep doing what you're doing, except when that happens, pull out your phone, take a notebook, write it on a napkin, whatever's there, whatever that word is, write it down. And that's all you have to do. Just by doing that, I somehow made it less scary, made it less big. It wasn't that I had to sit down and write a poem. It wasn't that I had to sit down and write a whole book. It was just, all I was asking is just to acknowledge that I had this thought, and it was fun to have it. I don't ever have to do anything with it. And then over time, having developed that habit, I would peruse them and look through those notes. And sometimes they would go further, and sometimes they wouldn't. And sometimes it would just come into a poem. The poem, and again, I had to lower my ask. The goal was not to complete a poem. If I completed a poem, the goal was not for the poem to be good. So I really had to settle myself down. That retaught me, my inner creative self, who I have been ignoring for years and years, that I was not going to be ignoring her anymore. That when I wasn't ignoring her, it wasn't because I was going to judge her for being good or not good. I really, it helped me to think of that self as a young child, and to treat her that way, and to be like, hey, we're just going to play. We're just going to have fun. And it has always been this way. I just didn't realize that that's what I was, and I had to shut it down. So if I go back to my younger self, to my high school self, even my 20s self, I would constantly be doodling, even in class, little notes, little pictures, little things, and snippets of thoughts and ideas. So that's just my natural way of writing. I just didn't recognize that that's what it was.
With a lot of your writing, like I said, some of it is about very serious subjects, but I can tell that you're having fun with those thoughts, you know? You know, I've talked to a number of poets who have described that experience to, I think, Cameron Morse he talks about the writing process and having fun with the interplay of words and just seeing how two words mesh up next to each other and how they'll have similar sounds and how that's fun for him. So, you know, even though he might be writing a poem that maybe the subject matter isn't what you would recognize as fun on the surface, the fact of the playing with words is itself quite enjoyable, quite fun. That's something that I'm always trying to get my students to know.
I think it helps to read silly poetry.
Well, that's my next question then, which is like, what do you like to read? What have you been reading to inspire yourself in your writing journey?
So I like to read poetry in general, and I also like to read fantasy and young adult fiction. So that's my escapism. I also read parenting books. But I find them to be very helpful to self-parent, actually. So
Yes.
I pick them up to like figure something out with like, oh, you know, if you have a difficult toddler and you're like, well, how do you know, deal with an obstinate, you know, child? And then you're actually figuring out, oh, you're actually reading how to parent yourself. And in terms of poetry, I like to really read a wide variety of poetry. All the poems that I read in high school and in college were very like a lot of white, a lot of men, you know, just these are our classics kind of stuff. And then when I started reading poetry again now, I wanted to go back and look at different voices and contemporary poets and things. I went back and I read a little bit more of Audre Lorde and Lucille Clifton and Mary Oliver, even because I really wanted to get a grounding of female voices and perspectives of not necessarily traditionally trained poets or traditionally educated poets.
Oh, yeah. Tell me more about that.
I love this, how powerful and visceral their work felt. Like it felt like they were speaking straight to my heart, and they did not use complicated words. They did not use complicated esoteric imagery. It felt like they were speaking, and it was very clearly at the same time poetry. It was a lesson and an invitation that you could say things in simple, approachable language that was deeply profound.
I think there's been some controversy, I guess, about it, some debate. Sometimes people thinking, like, well, because the language is so plain spoken, it's not as worthy as some of the other poetry. And I've been a I've bought on to that for a little while myself, and then I started, I think, really looking at Naomi Shihab Nye.
Oh, I love her. Yes.
And just going like, you know, this is approachable and I can understand it, and the fact that I can understand it on the first reading, maybe that's a plus, not a minus, you know?
They're
And
transformative, I
yeah.
think, because you can read them plainly as what they're saying, but they're saying, I feel them in my heart.
Yeah.
So they're clearly something beyond what's being said. And you could, you know, if you try to study what they're doing linguistically alone, I don't think it's enough. You have to kind of
Yes.
feel, it's a feeling that is generated. And I would much rather write a poem that generated that feeling in someone than, you know, excited their brain in terms, I mean, ideally you do both, but, you know,
Yes.
excited their brain because, oh, I use this esoteric word or this form, which is very difficult to write. But I'm not one of those people that says this is poetry and that isn't.
Yes,
I have
yeah.
a very open mind and acceptance of what poetry can look like.
Yeah, and I would say also their work, reading it and rereading it and writing essays about it, it's like it's still quite nuanced and layered. You can read it several times and gain more than one meaning.
Yes, I started with them and then I went on to look for more as a female voices, and there were a couple of journals that are some of my favorite journals, contemporary journals now, which Mom Egg Review is one, and Whale Road Review, my wonderful poet and a friend of mine now, Katie Manning, edits that one, and they publish such wonderful poems by men as well as women, but so much of the female experience, which I did not realize could and should be expressed in poetry, is in those pages, and it's so rich and so necessary, because these are things that you might feel very alone in, but are in many ways universal. And the poem by Deborah Kwan, The Night After You Lose Your Job, which I read in a poetry magazine, and it could have been written about any of my mom friends or me. And it was so beautiful and so well done. It just inspired me that, yeah, I should write my experience.
Yeah, that's really fantastic. So at this point, I want to ask a little bit about the two poems that you read at the top of the interview. Which one do you think came more easily to you?
Well, it's the title poem, All the Bad Girls Wear Russian Accents. It really came out almost the way it is now from the very get-go.
So tell me a little bit about the inspiration for that and how that one was generated.
Okay, so this was when I was, taking my analytical business mind and trying to figure out, like, what are the journals where I could probably be published, given the kind of work that I do and the kind of work that they publish. I'm a young in poetry, so I want to look perhaps at journals that are also not that old and established, because those are really competitive and hard to get into. And so I wanted to kind of find those. And then I found a bunch of journals, and many of them happened to be written and run by younger poets who were not just young in poetry, but young in life as well. And it struck me that their life experiences did not include being a mom or a dad, or, having worked extensively in a professional field. And they were so deeply entrenched in kind of the regular ethos and problems of the 20s, which is absolutely fine, but it lacked all this other. I'm like, oh, I could have written this in my 20s. And then I thought, okay, write a poem now as if you were in your 20s. But if you were writing from one of these contemporary journals, not, to an editor who's 25, right? And maybe you when you were 25. So you have all of your preconceived snooty notions about what literature is and isn't and whatnot. Or they love to print something which was a little bit irreverent and a little, sexy, women power and all of that. And I thought, okay, what would I write when I was in my 20s? As I was writing it, I had a lot of humor for myself at that age, but also for just having fun with writing, and that this poem came out and I really liked it. So
it's really fun and funny. Is that true? I mean, did people used to ask you to say things in Russian?
100%.
And
all the time. One of the first things, and I used to have an accent. So I don't now. I worked really hard to lose it, because of course, when you were a teenager, you do not want to stand out in any way that makes you different. But I did. And then people would find out that it was Russian. And so the first things they would say, but like, say something in Russian. And they always wanted to know the bad words, right?
Yeah, of course.
And then of course, if you teach them the bad words, who are they going to practice the bad words on? The only person who can understand them, which is you. And so I very quickly learned to teach them nice things that I wanted to hear.
That's very clever. I approve of that. Did you often tell them what the translation actually meant?
Yeah, I did. In the poem, I say, I make it a bit more, as an older person, I think more about assumptions that we make and appearances and how we judge each other. And when you're a teenager, you're trying to figure out what your identity is and what your tribe is and how you fit in. And you want to look cool. And we often kind of try on different personalities that may not be the best personalities in the end, but we kind of try to figure ourselves out.
I was thinking about that not long ago, because in the 80s, all the bad guys were Russian. And we always assumed that the Russian accent meant something sinister. I mean, do you feel like our attitudes towards Russia now are quite complicated?
I think they definitely are complicated right now by the war and by our relationship. In the 90s, which is when I had my high school experiences and this poem references, it's strange that those are so relevant now, because I'm a Russian speaker from Ukraine. So I was born in Ukraine, and many people from Ukraine speak fluent Russian for complicated reasons as well. So the simple idea in America now is that you have sympathy for Ukrainians and hatred for Russians. When you're a Russian from Ukraine, and there's where do you sit, right?
Yes.
Obviously, against the war and against the devastation, that's it's heartbreaking. And it's very complex, even in our political system. When we were, for so long, Russia was the bad guy. And then, oh, maybe not. Maybe we will invest in Russia and we will all have a wonderful democracy and we're all friends and we'll move forward. And then now again, they're the aggressor. And obviously, the common Russian people aren't making these choices. It's not up to them, right? It's the government that is making the choices. And right now, even Russian restaurants have changed their names and are no longer Russian restaurants. They're because they're trying to explain. Because I think before it was easier to say you were Russian because no one knew where Ukraine was, right? And now everyone knows where Ukraine is, and for a heartbreaking reason.
I definitely don't see this as being a war between Russia and Ukraine. I see it as being a war between Putin and Ukraine, and a lot of the Russian people are pawns being used.
At the mercy of their circumstances, as you know, are we all?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know from your writing, you're Russian Jewish, which is also how my husband identifies. So I wanted to ask now about the other poem, and I don't know if you know this poem. It's called "To Go to Lvov." Is a poem by Adam Zagajowski. Yeah. I came across this poem when I was an early poet and kind of getting to know the city through reading that poem over and over for the last, I think, 15 years, maybe, and have never felt comfortable pronouncing the name of the city. Can you say it again?
Lvov. And I don't speak Polish, but I have read Adam Zagajewski. Is beautiful writer. It's a love letter. Like, I feel like a lot of his poems are actually love letters. He has such a beautiful way of seeing the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, I'm not an expert. So oddly enough, it wasn't until the war began and Lvov was in the news so much that I started thinking, like, whoa, this city I keep hearing about in this poem that I keep reading, what is its history? And is it in Poland or is it in Russia? Or can you say a little bit about it and also about how it relates to your poem?
So it's interesting. It's my hometown. And, you know, I was born there. It's an international city on the border between Poland and Ukraine now. And when I lived there, it was still in the Soviet Union. And it has had many, many identities. It was the Western capital of Ukraine for a little bit before Kiev. And it was called like the little Prague of the Soviet Union because it is a medieval city. It has a lot. It had a city center with a wall around it, like the feudal cities did. And then that kept expanding. The walls kept growing outside, outside, outside. It is, its symbol is the lion. So it had these beautiful stone lions and a lot of official architecture everywhere. Architecturally, very beautiful city. And because it kept constantly being conquered by one country or the other, it had these influences from different cultures and in a certain way became multinational, multicultural, and open, where there was also another element which was very nationalistic. And on the one hand, it inherited a lot of beauty from the different cultures, but on the other hand, it had a lot of oppression to contend with. And then there's, of course, the history of Jews in Ukraine and how terrible their fate was. And how the local population was stirred up with a lot of nationalistic hatred and fervor to the point that they were very enthusiastic in exterminating their Jews. And we came here as refugees from the Soviet Union and from Ukraine. It is such a complicated grief because on the one hand, we love our home country and we had wonderful Ukrainian neighbors and wonderful Polish, you know, people of Polish descent who stayed in neighbors. And then there were very commonly people of Ukrainian and non-Jewish descent who were just terrible, and yeah. Jewish kids got beaten up. And, you know, the poem came from this deep love of that homeland and this sudden, almost PTSD feeling of hearing it mentioned constantly in the news, and what it brought up for me, even though I was very young when we escaped the Soviet regime. I was 10 years old. But how deeply those past generational traumas are embedded in the kind of cellular memory of our generations and our children, too.
Yeah.
And I wanted to write something which spoke about it, but didn't wallow in the death and the atrocity that was happening now. I wanted the poem to offer a sense of, to hold all the truths of it, to hold the love we have for each other and the hate we have for each other, and how you cannot separate these two things. You can't just speak about what's happening in Ukraine. Raising the Ukrainian flag as a symbol of freedom without acknowledging when it wasn't. You can't just hold on to the trauma endlessly either, because there's good and there's life and there's love in every country, in every language, in every nation. It's not a poem that has a resolution, right? It is about that struggle, this idea of like, what's that word? Like, this word is so powerful to me, but what does it mean? It means a lot and it means nothing at the same time.
When you say that word, you mean the name of the city?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true for anyone who's writing about history. All of our words, all of our countries, all of our people or groups have a dark side and a light side. All history is complicated. And yes. I can see we're trying to write about that, where you are yourself kind of in this nesting doll situation. You know, we're in a group that's being oppressed within this group that's now also being oppressed. And so how do you identify? How do you write about something? I love what you said. Naming God is an ambition I do not share. I am only trying to unpack one girlhood's worth of beginning. Each language a nesting doll, carrying inside itself all the recipes and ingredients of a people, their poetry and their death certificates, their library songs and kill orders, health records, love letters, addresses we can't return to. It's taking something very big and like yet trying to make it a reasonable scope. Just not the name of God, just one girlhood. You know, as if that weren't big enough.
That's complicated enough and endless enough that you will never get to the root of it. This poem took longer because it was dealing with so many complicated. I felt like I had to honor the experience of so many people and to be careful and gentle with the truth of not just myself and my ancestors, but anyone else who might read this. I did not want this to re-traumatize anyone. And that's actually the poetry that was coming out at the time. I was hesitant to read if it was about Ukraine because I was afraid of being wounded, not healed by it. And I wanted this to be something that felt like a healing, like a airing out that was gentle, that was kind, and not saccharine or too simplistic. And I think it's one of the poems I'm most proud of ever writing, both in terms of how I was able to express myself, but also on a linguistic point. When I start out, the idea that I was like, you read that paragraph, and it comes back to addresses we can't return to, which I mentioned in the beginning paragraph, which is none of us can ever go back to our soul's point of entry into this world. So there were times when I was finessing the poem where my kind of analytical linguist part came in. I made those connections deliberate and changed some words so there were echoes of what I had opened up with in the end. And there was a book ending in terms of Lviv, Ukraine at the top and then Lviv, Ukraine at the bottom. And looking at the literal situation, which is literally true, there's near constant bombardment. that's happening in my hometown or near my hometown. And then there's the near constant bombardment of hearing that word on the news over and over again, and how it's making me stop and think, what does it mean? What is where I come from? But where do I come from? How do I make sense in this world? And that's a very personal question and a universal question. You do not have to come from Ukraine or be a refugee to be grappling with these issues of identity, to be grappling with the greater meaning of life, and just maybe the more approachable, but just as difficult to decipher the meaning of our own beginnings and where we're headed, given where we're from.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about this. You say this is the one that was more difficult. So what allowed you to enter the poem? What allowed you to edit the poem?
I think I had to write it out to see how I felt. Parts of it worked right away, but parts of it didn't. Mm. And I felt this weight of how is this going to be read by others? And how do I represent more than myself? And that's the other piece that I really wanted this book to do, and I hope I do, is I wanted to put in not just my perspective, but how somebody who doesn't share my perspective might view the same situation. Mm. Everyone seemed so angry and mad at each other in our country. Everyone seemed so quick to point to the others as evil and completely wrong, and let's not even talk to each other. Let's not, you know, and that just felt like the wrong way to go. I read it to my sister, who was like, oh my God, are you seriously going to make me hear a poem about this? Because she was like, no, I'm not having it. And I'm like, I know, I promise you, it's not going to make you devastated. Like, I didn't say it was not going to make you cry, because we both cried. But she was the one who was able to hear what I was trying to say. She was kind of, she told me that I had articulated what she was feeling and she could not articulate this dichotomy, and that encouraged me that I needed to finish it. And she helped identify the places where it really resonated with her and the places where it just didn't. So that was a really good opening for me. And then I went back to her after I worked on it again, and she had gone back. She told me that my dad is, our father has had passed away, but she said, do you know, remember that Papa's first language was Yiddish, and he learned Russian later, but he grew up in a shtetl. And I was like, yes. And then she said, so her husband's grandmother survived the war, but her shtetl didn't. And so there were these personal accounts that she had read from her. And she told me about that story, this devastating story of this thriving little town, which was completely wiped out, all the men, women, and children, and the records that were kept. So that really brought up for me this idea of record keeping and who gets to then position those records, who gets to tell the history from which standpoint. And we happen to be in a place where there's a lot of voices telling that story, and we get to see different perspectives. It was, you know, a difficult process to touch those personal family stories and to say them, and then to kind of, once it's all in here, polish it up so that it works as a poem in terms of the language. You know, where do I put, you know, what imagery works? The nesting doll imagery was something I added at the end.
Yeah.
And I really loved that analogy. It kind of clicked in for me after having sat with it for a while, especially when I talked about a girlhood. Because as a girl, you would play with a doll. Once one thing became clear, other things kind of came in. It opens. Sometimes I find that in a poem, when I fix or I adjust one word, then other things are sort of like I've opened a door for the rest of it to flow in and be like, okay, then this stacks on that and that stacks on that. And together it makes a better, more successful poem.
I love that you read it to your sister. Is this an older or younger sister?
My older sister, yeah.
And is she a poet or an artist on her own?
She's an artist at heart. She's a very creative person. It's not what she does for a living. She's someone I deeply admire and respect. So
I love that she was resistant to it first, you know, and then yet you were able to win her over. How are you getting this into more hands? How are you getting this book into all the hands so that we can all maybe see things a little bit more nuanced?
Well, it is available on Amazon and at Kelsey Books and on my website at which is palmfrondzoo.com. And I'm doing it badly because I'm a new poet, and it's just me. And it's okay. So this collection is a chapbook, so I find that it's not only does it have accessible language, but it's short, so it doesn't really, you don't have to feel like, oh my gosh, I will never get through it.
Yeah, I read this in 2 afternoons.
Well done. Yeah, it's meant to. It packs a punch, but it's not asking you to spend days and days on it. So I'm learning this process of publishing and promotion, and I'm not great at it, I have to say, but I have done some. I have been lucky enough that there's a wonderful community in San Diego, and we have done things at the San Diego Public Library. That's where I had my book launch, at the Central Library. And then we have the Festival of Books, which is put on by the San Diego Union Tribune, which happens every year at USD campus. So I will be on the poetry stage there with our San Diego Poet Laureate, Jason Magaba Perez. So I'm getting myself on podcasts like this and
yes.
kind of trying to be active in the community. And I need help. So
no,
if you have advice,
yeah,
I take it.
I'm kind of joking around with that. I think that's a thing poets have so much difficulty with. We all do. Poetry, it's a thing. Go to your library.
Yeah, I think Amanda Gorman did a lot for people. And obviously,
yes.
Ada Limon, our new poet laureate of the United States, is doing a lot to promote poetry and remind people that it is this ancient, fantastic art form, which is so vital to us. I think people forget about poetry, and then they see something like that, they're so deeply moved, and then they're like, poetry, yes!
You know, one of the first writers I really fell in love with was Yvonne Boland, who's an Irish poet, and she said something like there was a campaign to put poetry in the seat cushions of the planes from, you know, United Ireland Airlines.
In London, they did the underground poems where they had poems in the underground, in the tube. I think New York did this for a while. But I do think that obviously more funding for the arts and more poetry in schools is one way to go for sure.
A friend of the Poetry Salon cast, we had her on couple years ago. Janine Hall Gailey has a book out called PR for Poets, a guidebook to publicity and marketing, which you can get on Amazon and probably wherever else fine books are sold.
I think for me, I want to do things that don't feel so far outside of my comfort zone, which may not be the smartest strategy, but we all just have so many resources, so much energy, so much time.
Yeah.
And you got to do things that feel true to you, I think. Well,
so,
I want to thank you for creating the podcast and this community and an opportunity for poets to find each other and people to find poets. And I do that part I do enjoy because I do like going to readings by people and magazines I admire. So you and I met through Sheila Nagle's reading. And now we're doing this. And then who knows, you know, where we might meet somebody else and put each other in touch. And so that kind of thing feels very organic and natural and comfortable to me.
It's magical. And it's all over the world now. I do not want to say thank you to the pandemic, but I'll say thank you to whoever built Zoom. We can also act globally. We can also talk to people from far away. We can stay connected. And we can learn about people from other places. And, you know, it just makes us a lot closer.
And more accessible because, you know, especially moms and parents, like for me, it would have been really hard to go to open mics and also intimidating as a person outside the community. But when things went on Zoom, it was so easy. You could have your camera off. You could just kind of sneak in and see what the what. You know? And if you didn't like it, you could leave. So that was, I think that's a really wonderful invitation for people who may not be able to access poetry otherwise?
I'm most comfortable when I'm helping. So one of the ways I plugged in was by volunteering, doing a lot of things. And through that, I helped with three other poets found the San Diego chapter Women Who Submit Lit, which is a wonderful nonprofit organization with lots of free resources, which was helpful to me because when I literally Googled how to be a poet, they were one of the first places that came up that was quite useful to read. Yeah, that's another way for someone who may be shy about stepping into this new space. If there's an organization locally or online that you admire and you want to volunteer with, that's a good way to meet people.
This has been such a fabulous interview. I really enjoy you taking the time to talk about your own process, talk about your experiences in Ukraine and Russia and your unique on the grounds human perspective, nuanced perspective about it. And I love this book and just want to encourage all of our readers to go get it. You can get it from Kelsey Books. It's All the Bad Girls Wear Russian Accents.
It's a cheeky title. Thank you so much for having me. I had a lot of fun talking with you about all the topics, and I'll be looking forward to doing a reading with you guys soon.
Yes.
And to listening to the other poets you have on the podcast. It's fantastic.
Once again, Jane Mushenitz, welcome to the poetry community. We are so glad to have you here.
You have been listening to the Poetry Salon Cast, brought to you by the Poetry Salon. If you enjoyed this interview, you can find out more about the events we offer, the workshops and editing services that we host online, and a variety of other ways to get involved with the Poetry Salon by going to www.thepoetrysalon.com. You can also become a member of our free Facebook group, The Poetry Salon Online, and you can also find me, Tricia Faye Hefner, at Poet Tricia on Instagram. Thanks for listening.